Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, I didn't have a choice. Those were the words uttered by the CMPD officer who shot down Quirrius Franklin, heard in the lengthier version of body cam footage released by a judge this week. Republican candidates running for the congressional seat in the 9th District appear at a public forum as early voting in the GOP primary begins. City Council works on recommendations to better serve immigrants, and as further plans emerge for the Panthers' proposed headquarters and practice facility in South Carolina. One legislator there calls the promise of benefits to the state for offering incentives fool's gold. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those stories and others, and those reporters are David Borax from WFAE News. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Jonathan Lowe, reporter anchor for Spectrum News, is with us. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
Mary C. Curtis, contributor to WCCB TV and columnist for Roll Call, also with us again this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
And Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Mike.
We're all on the radio, and as you can plainly see, there's a camera over there. You can watch us on Facebook Live. Last week, after WBTV's Nick Oxner successfully convinced a court to have CMPD release a body cam video of the Dan Quirrius Franklin shooting, the department released a short clip and showed moments before and the actual shooting of Mr. Franklin. That video ended with the officer picking up Mr. Franklin's gun. This week, after Nick Oxner filed another motion, a judge told CMPD to release the rest of the video. It picks up where the previous one left off.
Stay over there! We need your unit out here now.
That is Mr. Franklin moaning in the background in pain. Another part of the video has Officer Wendy Curl exclaiming that she made her decision to shoot because she didn't have a choice.
I shot him.
Huh?
I shot him.
All right.
He pulled a gun. He wouldn't drop it.
So what else, if anything, have we learned from this lengthier edition of this video?
Well, I think one thing that has stood out this week is the question of medical aid for someone who is shot or injured in a police incident. You heard Chief Putney saying that the department has to do better. There's been a lot of speculation. You can't see on the video exactly whether anyone is tending to Dan Quirrius Franklin, but it seems that no one is until, what, 4 or 5 minutes into the video?
I did the math. It was about 4 minutes between the time of the shooting actually taking place and the first, it was actually paramedics from Charlotte Fire, because the medic was called.
Is that normal? I'm sorry. Is that normal operating procedure for CMPD if you shoot somebody, just to leave them there until the emergency personnel arrive who can administer greater first aid?
Well, one would think so, but the chief actually spoke to that this week and confirmed that officers, and he actually said that and this was prior to the entire video being released, said that he, you know, what you see there is troubling. And he was speaking to the fact that there was no medical aid until those paramedics got there. I do remember asking CMPD this specific question prior to the 9 minutes being released, because there were some questions from the community about whether medical aid was rendered. CMPD told me that all officers are trained in CPR, so one would then assume that these two officers would be. I then responded back and asked, well, were these two officers, being Wendy Curl and the other officer, Larry Deal, were they trained in CPR? And they were not. So,
and in fact,
a very confusing situation.
And to the point of whether aid was rendered there, obviously, as you just described, it was several minutes before anybody got to it, and it was when the paramedics got there. But Putney did announce this week what a change in policy, that
right,
we will now have medic and fire stage when we're called to an incident scene like that. Now, that's one of those things. Is that going to happen the way they think it will?
I don't think so, David, because we know that when any shooting scene that we go to, that they will not allow the paramedics in until the scene is secure.
Right.
Well, the idea is that they would stage somewhere.
Correct.
It would be
until it's safe to go in.
But the idea would be that you get called to a scene like this and medic and fire are called at the same time. I mean, if that is the new policy, we'll see if it works out in future cases like this.
Why not, since we're training fire department personnel to be first responders, why aren't police officers being trained?
Perfect question. That's why it's so confusing, because again, one would think, Mike, that that's something that they address in the academy.
Minor first aid. I don't know if you shoot somebody, that's
just
pretty severe.
CPR. So.
CPR would not have made a difference.
Right,
in this case.
And that's another
it
issue.
Have, but just applying pressure to the wound.
Yeah. What exactly was the extent of the injuries during that time is one of the questions. Another question, of course, that popped up this week is, you mentioned Officer Larry Deal and the fact that his body camera was not on, and there was reporting, I think by multiple people, that one of his body cameras had been, the battery had been dead for almost 3 months, and the other one was at 95% battery level. I think this was WBTV reporting this, that it was at 95% battery level but turned off the night before this shooting occurred. So obviously there's no tape from that.
And Chief Putney has talked about that as well. That was a disturbing piece of it, and that if that was turned off, it wasn't turned on, that was not a part of department policy.
So what's the punishment for that? I mean, is there a fine or a?
I know that it's under internal investigation, so we don't know the outcome. But he is currently on suspension for another matter, so this has not been dealt with yet internally.
Yes. So officially, there's been we've talked about this a lot, and I'm sure it's been talked about around the country, the use of these body cam videos, because there's concern that the public will react in a negative way, and perhaps incorrectly in a negative way, because it doesn't show what you are typically seeing on TV, because we watch a lot of cop shows, and what you see on TV is highly staged and shot to show you precisely what you need to see. These videos are not, as this latest video fairly clearly demonstrates. So what has been the reaction to this video as opposed to the 2-minute 20-second video that came out last week?
I think we're going to see a lot of policy change, both on the city level and the state level. I know that House Bill 791, which I think you're alluding to.
Actually, no, but go ahead.
Well, I will go ahead and say that the state is looking at there are two legislators, Representative Kelly Alexander, which is everybody knows him locally, and Representative John Faircloth. It's House Bill 791. Basically would give city councils and county elected leaders the authority to view a body cam video without court approval. But the catch is they would have to sign a confidentiality agreement, basically saying we'll watch this behind closed doors and we won't speak about it publicly.
Another policy change that's come out of this that the chief announced is that going forward, they will present all of the video to a judge and then make an argument for which section should be redacted. And in this case, the way it happened is the city council saw the whole 11 minutes and then they brought to the judge only 2 minutes and 20 seconds, which is what they felt met the requirements of the request. And going forward, it will happen differently. And I think the intention of the law originally was that a judge would decide what is worth sharing with the public.
Well, you remember this law was... Oh, I'm sorry, Mary, go ahead.
No, I'll just say much of this has ended up in court because they'll argue that it means the person could not get a fair trial. Mm-hmm. And so this is ultimately often going to be a legal issue.
So let's back up, because for people who are new to town or don't remember this happening, is that the release of police video to the public or even to city officials is to be determined according to state law, which is a recent state law.
2016, right.
By a judge. So not even city council members, not the city manager. Nobody can see this video until the judge rules on it. However, city council did see this 11-minute video. City Councilman Braxton Winston during a debate about the video on Monday night said it was a flagrant skewing of the evidence for the police to have presented only 2 minutes and 20 seconds of the video to the judge as opposed to the entire 11 minutes. And he said that local law enforcement, this is a quote, local law enforcement and the policies that govern them should be under local control. The law prevents all parties, the city attorney, the city manager, and Charlotte's elected officials from effectively doing our jobs. How many people on council agree with him?
Well, I think at least in part, when you Dimple Ashmiro agreed, and Matt Newton, who's a lawyer, made the comment about going back to what David said, that the discrepancy between the 2 minutes and 20 seconds released and the full 11 minutes, Matt Newton said that essentially the police were playing legalese instead of releasing the full video, that it was kind of parsing the language when most reasonable people would think, okay, all 11 minutes should
remember be. Remember, the press release that came out with the release of the two minutes and 20 seconds said something like, we've released all relevant video yeah. to the request right. of the judge's order.
So on Monday, if you remember, CMPD was called back into court over this because of the possibility of being in contempt of court. The assistant city attorney, Jessica Battle, who works for the city attorney but often represents CMPD in these situations, she got up, and I'm paraphrasing, but basically she said something to the effect of, you know, CMPD has always had this ability to, when they have released in the past, video to determine how much they let city council see. And to her, what she stated is basically that when they made the decision on how much to release, and the chief took responsibility and ultimate responsibility for it, but that they were concerned about Officer Wendy Curl not receiving due process if they released the entire video. So that's kind of the other side of this, that the explanation we got.
This gets really confusing. I've read this yesterday in 14 different versions from different writers, and it was almost impossible for me to follow the logic behind all of this or what actually happened. But this 11-minute video was revealed this week after city council was shown it, and that city council was shown it prior to any judge giving permission for the city council to show it. And Chief Putney told the court that he showed the footage to council at the direction of city manager Marcus Jones.
Did you express any concern about your authority or lack of authority to do so?
I did express my concern to do so, yes.
Was there any response from the city manager?
There was.
What was that response?
The city attorney had assured him that it was indeed okay to do.
So that's Chief Putney being questioned by WBTV's attorney because they were petitioning for the release of that video. State law places him in charge of releasing or not releasing the video to a judge, correct? Not
right.
to council.
Correct.
Right.
Right.
So the mayor said the council viewed it on the advice of the city attorney. Can we assume then that their seeing the video was in compliance with the law?
You know, at Monday night's council meeting, Mayor Lyles called it a mistake. And she said, you know, sometimes we do things with good intentions, but it doesn't work out that way. And sometimes people make mistakes, but it's not really with negative intentions. She was trying to kind of, I think, maybe gloss over the fact that they saw this inappropriately.
I was just going to say, Mike, you started that question or the intro to that clip by talking about how confusing this is. Yeah. Not only is it confusing, Mike, but all of these discrepancies, these gray nuances, they chip away further at what is already a lot of mistrust in the community between the police and residents, and particularly minority residents. And so when you talk about inadvertently seeing a video, when you talk about releasing 2 minutes and 20 seconds instead of 11 minutes, all these things, I think it just serves to feed a narrative and a perception that, you know, this is not being done fairly.
So we'll come back to that. We'll come back to Marcus Jones because he said the city manager has had something to say about why he let the council see this. And we'll continue with other news of the day, including the fact that the 9th District race is now officially underway and early voting has begun in that race as well. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with David Borax here from WFAE News, Eric Spanberg, Charlotte Business Journal's managing editor, Mary C. Curtis, columnist for Roll Call, contributor to WCCB-TV, and Jonathan Lowe, reporter for Spectrum News. So we were talking about the release of the full, well, I guess it's the full 11-minute video. Who knows if there's more this week by CMPD to the public, but it first went to city council. It has to be the state law says that a judge has to make a decision about who sees what when, and evidently council saw this without permission of a judge. They consulted the city attorney. He said it was okay, and the city manager Marcus Jones says he made the decision to allow the council to see the entire video because he believes it was in the community's best interests.
There weren't a list of concerns that the chief raised. He just, you know, suggested that maybe this is something that maybe we shouldn't do. And I said, I believe this is something that we should do. So ultimately, it was my call.
Ultimately, it was his call. What does state law have to say about that?
That's a good question. I don't know if anyone else has heard. I have not heard anything about whether there's any possible repercussion for making that decision.
And the law that I've read doesn't mention the city manager telling.
Yeah, it's not. This whole thing sounds like a clown circus.
I'm going to go back to what you said. It's so confusing and head spinning because there's an inadvertent showing of a video. There is, you played the clip from the chief earlier saying that, he was told by the city manager to do this. So that also brings into question, what's the point of the 2016 state law if cities can go around this, and have other cities gone around it in North Carolina? I don't know.
So, reaction to this 11-minute video, there was reaction to the 2-minute and 20-second video. It was the reaction to the 11-minute video, Mary, substantially different from the public's point of view.
Oh, yeah. Well, as Eric brought up earlier, you're coming from mistrust anyway, and when you don't have the full video, people are going to fill in the blanks before they have it, even before they see the whole thing. And then when they see it, I think a lot of people did key on the fact that medical attention wasn't there. So do you see this person as a human being? And it's a question of benefit of the doubt. A lot of folks in the minority community know that police have a difficult job. But many said he didn't have a chance to comply. Do you see him as a complete human being? And
they asked him 24 times to drop the gun.
Yes, yeah. And
but the key to that is he didn't have the gun in his hand when they were asking him to drop the gun.
And then his quote, "You told me to," was he trying to, put it down? The fact that it was shouting, and do folks have enough training to deal with people who are in distress and how they deal with that? And so you're going to have that. You saw the vigil that they have had for Mr. Franklin, just trying to say he's not just a victim of a police shooting, but he was a father, and he was a person with gifts, and he might have had problems, but how are you dealing with him? And it's building, of course, Keith Lamont Scott and all these other things. This isn't happening in a vacuum. And so there will be a lot of questions. And when you have these other issues, like the other officer being suspended for something else, but we don't know exactly what because of the secrecy of the records. You're just building up all of these questions and doubts in folks' minds. And we have to think of what's going to happen the next time and the next time.
Jonathan.
I was going to add to what Mary just said, but with this, that while we have had the emotional response from the public, there's also been these very smart, pointed, cogent questions about what people have seen in the video, technical questions about and things that we've heard the chief also kind of echo, meaning with the commands, could they change, asking him instead of put down the gun, put your hands where I can see them, take your index. The chief actually showed in one interview your index finger and your thumb. Let me see. Just some of the technical questions, why, people asking, why did it not play out this way? Yeah. And so I think there's been an emotional response, but also a very technical, measured, so far what we've seen in these rallies and these protests and these vigils.
Even
it's
experts.
It's intense, but I wouldn't say nothing's boiled over.
Yeah, even experts have said, even if indeed it is ruled a justifiable shooting, were there things that could have been done? Could she have taken cover and not been right there, so that would have given them more time to assess the situation. As you say, Jonathan, there are a lot of questions asked by folks.
So Cass Ottley, who is an activist, here was her reaction as she stood outside, I think, CMPD headquarters with others and watched the full video on her phone.
This officer needs to be fired. This officer needs to be charged. I am so upset right now. It's beyond ridiculous. Chief Putney, Mayor Val Lyles, the city manager, city council, and everyone else, they need to be held accountable.
Gemini Boyd, who was recently on this program, he's another community activist and community organizer, also called for more accountability, especially considering the series of community meetings that officials have been holding and were holding before the full 11-minute video was released.
They knew what was on the video. This was all damage control. All these town halls that you all have been out here and you've seen and you heard at all these different churches that was held, it was damage control.
So he's saying that the people involved in these meetings knew the full video. They'd seen the full video, and yet they went in there talking to people who had not seen the full video, and it was kind of a dog and pony show. I think that's what he's saying. That's a lack of trust.
Yeah. As long as you have that lack of trust, you're going to have the worst possible motives in your mind, no matter if that is true or not. So that's going to take a long-term effort.
Essentially, people are like saying, were you just giving us lip service?
Yeah, well, and I would say that, remember, although circumstances are different in some ways, we had all these debates and a lot of distrust in 2016 over the video release with Keith Lamont Scott.
Right.
And even before that, going back to previous shootings that were controversial and high profile, we've had police chiefs and others talking about trying to, your point, to de-escalate and to train officers. And I don't say this lightly. I mean, I'm sure it is incredibly complex and incredibly difficult. But on the other side, there is a lot of frustration about the fact that a lot of people think the de-escalation is not taking hold.
Yeah, and another thing about this is that since 2016, there's been pledges of, you know, new policies, better training and all that from CMPD. And a lot of the questions that people are asking, the reaction to it this week is, you know, what happened to all of that?
Yeah,
we're back in the same place we were in 2016.
If you watch the full video, there is no evidence of any de-escalation taking place or any attempt to de-escalate. Jonathan?
And Mike, I just wanted to, this point is relevant. CMPD is actually having today a news conference at 10:30 to announce the impending launch of CMPD's Community Policing Crisis Response Team, which has come out of all of this that these two officers were not CRT trained.
And I should mention, or I should actually ask Jonathan to mention, there was a response right from the officer's attorney in terms of, you know, the decisions made and what's seen in the video.
And that's important, because Mike, because he also, her attorney, Jeremy Smith, was at the hearing earlier this week and said, in addition to others, that they wanted initially the entire video to be released. And so he put out a statement. She apparently wanted to say something sooner, but I'm just going to give you a little small piece of it. It was a very long statement, five paragraphs, but he goes in to say, what has never been mentioned is that there was an innocent civilian talking to Mr. Franklin, Danquirius Franklin, no more than a few feet away.
In the car.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And then we know that person was the general manager.
Okay. And when the officer approached the door of the car, the first thing she told him to do was put your hands where I can see them.
And he did, of course.
But
also, I think this brings up the fact that we've been talking so much about a video, and it's true, you know, that's very important, video evidence. But it also proves that even when you have videos, people are going to see, you know, different things. They're going to interpret it in different ways. Video is not definitive.
Well, in this longer video, and I don't know what to make of this, but I'm going to throw it out here. In the longer video, later on in the video, after the shooting has occurred and the dust is cleared, so to speak, another officer attempts to comfort Wendy Curl, the officer who fired the fatal shots. The other officer asks, you're all right, you're all right. You're sitting here talking, right? You got kids at home, right? You want to see them this evening, right? And Curl responds, yeah. And the other officer replies, that's what matters. Now, that is a natural response. It is a comforting response for the officer involved. But does it speak in some way to how police view their jobs and their right to use lethal force? You're sitting here, you're fine, you're going home. That's what matters.
It almost sounds like that's what they tell each other before they leave. Like, your job is to come back safely. Your job,
you've like got to... Hill Street Blues, yeah. Be safe out there. Mm-hmm. Okay. Chief Putney says that there are dozens of other videos that were likely recorded by cameras worn by officers who came to the scene. Will all these other videos be released?
That's a
very good question. We don't know the answer to that. By the way, in all this discussion, I don't know if we've mentioned that this is now a matter that has gone to the DA's office, and over the next 90 days, they will make the determination on whether there are charges against the officer. So we'll
and the criminal investigation is also continuing, and the internal investigation, which would determine whether the officers broke any policies. And of course, we're all looking at that because we know that there was only one video, and there should have been
more.
The community waits.
Right.
So as the judge was deciding on whether or not to release this 11-minute video, which ultimately did, CMPD announced that it was implementing a series of changes, some of which I guess will be talked about this morning at 10:30. It will now be their policy to release, quote, all relevant video footage of critical incidents, including officer-involved shootings, for a judge to decide what is appropriate for the public to see. Who in the department decides what is relevant?
I'm assuming it would be the person that made that announcement, Deputy Chief Stella Patterson, who runs internal investigations.
So the police can decide what is relevant to show the judge so that the judge can decide what the public can see? Is that what I'm understanding?
There again is that.
Well,
I thought it was the judge. You show the entire
everything.
Thing.
Yeah,
I
thought that Chief Putney said at some point this week that while the new policy would put everything in the judge's hands, the police would still request redactions and other things that would be protected or eliminated because of circumstances that could affect.
Okay.
So in this case, what would have happened if they followed this procedure is they would have given the whole 11 minutes to the judge and then said, we think you should only release 2 minutes and 20 seconds. That would have been CMPD's dream scenario.
And things like this is a bystander whose face we don't want to be revealed. Things like that that will factor into this.
Which is what happened with the 2 minute, 20 second video. They showed it to the judge. The judge said, no, I want this and that redacted. So that happens anyway. So.
Because there are legitimate legal concerns about being able to get a fair trial in the aftermath of this.
Right.
And if you prejudice the jury pool, you can't get a fair trial. Okay, let's move on to something less complicated. The 9th District. There are 10 Republicans running for Congress in the 9th District primary redo this week. The Mecklenburg County Young Republicans held a forum that drew 5 of the 10 candidates: Stevie Rivenbark of Fayetteville, Fern Schubert of Marshville, Lee Brown of Cabarrus County, Stoney Rushing from Union County, and State Senator Dan Bishop from here were all part of that forum. What were the key topics that they chose to address?
Well, you don't have a jar here because I have to say HB2.
Of course.
So go ahead and put some money in the jar.
Because Dan Bishop is the architect.
Yes, because Dan Bishop is the architect. One of the other headlines that came out, of course, is Lee Brown is a realtor in Cabarrus County, and she has benefited from, I think, about $1.3 million of PAC support for her candidacy, and Dan Bishop in particular said that was problematic. And then, of course, I think probably the highlight that wasn't actually part of the debate but that went along with the debate is Stoney Rushing has a very interesting video wherein he stands in a swamp with a snake draped around his neck and so on and so forth. So it was just another ho-hum week.
Stoney Rushing is the guy who's photographed as Boss Hogg.
Boss Hogg.
Stoney Rushing is also a big fan of Mark Harris and thinks that the election fraud whole case should not have happened.
Well, Rushing, Mark Harris endorsed him.
Rushing says he stood by Harris when Harris was running. He stands by Harris now, and that the bipartisan State Board of Elections, which called for this new vote, is the, quote, crookedest bunch of people you're ever going to meet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds like Donald Trump.
Well, also, that's another point of it. They all really back Donald Trump. They got out of the way to see who could back him the most.
Yes, indeed. The Mueller report was a key moment in the debate, evidently.
I don't know of anybody else on the planet that could have withstood the kind of attacks he's been under nonstop since the day he took the job.
This witch hunt is treason.
If you wanted to conduct a coup with the United States, you certainly wouldn't do it with a well-disciplined military. What you would use would be the instrumentalities of prosecutorial law enforcement, and that's what they sought to do.
That's Lee Brown, Stevie Rivenbach, and Dan Bishop in that order. Fern Schubert also called the Mueller investigation a very expensive joke. Will this be a key topic in this election?
I think...
Go ahead. I was just going to say, I think that what we've seen all over the country is going to play out here, which is that if you're a Republican candidate, it is essentially a competition to say who can support the president the most. And so, yes, you're going to hear the pro-Trump, you're going to hear the pro-gun, and you're going to hear the anti-abortion. I mean, those three issues really resonated throughout that debate.
And also that Democrats are socialists. You'll hear a lot
Does this resonate beyond President Trump's base? And this, President Trump arguably is the Republican Party right now.
Definitely. It is the party of Trump.
So does this resonate beyond the base of that?
That doesn't matter right now because this is a primary and you are trying to get the Republican faithful to come out and vote for you. So therefore,
so when you
every
move
one
into
of these
the general, if this becomes a key thing in the primary, when you move to run against Dan McCready, the Democrat and the Libertarian and the Green Party candidate, do you have to change what you're talking about?
I think you always have to pivot at least some when you get to a general election. I don't think anyone's going to make the 180 degree of Trump's right to Trump's wrong when you get in the general. I don't think it's like that. But I do think you have to moderate, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. Once you're done with the primary, you do have to try and come back to the middle, usually to win.
But you've already seen the playbook, though. They're going to try to connect Dan McCready with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and all these other folks. And
so I have a minute left in this segment. The primaries will be held on May the 14th. Early voting got underway this week. Only the Republican slate of candidates are on the ballot because it's a Republican primary. The other candidates have already been selected by their respective parties. Do we have any indication of turnout?
Very interesting note here. several outlets reporting, WSOC reporting, Charlotte Observer, and other Spectrum News, of course, that McCrae Dallas, who was at the center of the election fraud allegations, absentee ballot fraud operation we saw earlier this year. He was the very first person we know to cast a vote in Bladen County in the 9th district.
If he's convicted of a felony, then he won't be able to vote. So,
is that why he voted early?
I wonder.
Y'all have plenty of time to check it out. Right?
But here, I mean, turnout on the first day of early voting here in Mecklenburg County was very low.
Okay, we'll stop there. We'll cut. There's more to talk about. We'll come back and talk about it in a second. It's Charlotte Talks on WFA. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the Local News Roundup. Mary C. Curtis is here from Roll Call. Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News. Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. And David Borax from WFAE News. We're still talking about the 9th District off the air. We might as well continue on there. David, you wanted to follow up on what happens in the general.
Yeah, you were asking about what happens when we get to the general election. We'll be hearing the same kinds of things. And I think this will not be the same kind of a race that the Republicans are describing here during the primary between a conservative and, you know, far-left socialist candidate. I mean, Dan McCready is a moderate. He's a veteran. He is more of a centrist, and they will be forced to the center on this. And, you know, the electorate is not going to – they're going to try and paint him as a socialist, but I think he's going to have a good comeback to describe himself differently, and I think that could color the race. And so if we do get maybe one of the more extreme of these candidates, somebody who uses all of that language, it'll be interesting to see how it works out.
So we have 10 candidates in this race, in the Republican race. If none of the 10 candidates gets 30% of the vote, there will be a runoff in September. What is the likelihood of that happening?
I mean, if you look at the straw poll that the Mecklenburg Young Republicans just put out, both Dan Bishop and Matthew Ridenour, the former Mecklenburg mm-hmm. County Commissioner, were in the top two. Mm-hmm. Both of them got over 30% in that straw poll. So if that's any sort of example of what we may see, that may in fact happen.
But that's Mecklenburg County. Remember, this district goes
Correct.
All the way from Charlotte to Fayetteville.
Correct.
And it could swing on Union County votes. It could swing on votes in Fayetteville.
As it did
in Bladen County.
And Rushing was a huge vote-getter when he got the Union County Commission.
And remember, Union County is really what drove Mark Harris's victory.
And as the paper reported this morning, I didn't know this was true, but there are 5 of the 10 candidates who do not live in the district, and you don't have to. You only have to live in the state to run for Congress. And so if no runoff is necessary, the general election will be on September the 10th. If a runoff is necessary, the runoff will be held on September the 10th, and the election will be moving to November the 5th.
Which,
right?
You know, yes, you're right on all those dates. And
circle your calendars.
Well, but Mike, I mean, that's true, because think of the ramifications. If you have an election on September 10th, people are sort of foggy, recovering from their trip to the beach over Labor Day, versus you're part of the standard November election in terms of turnout. I think that's really important. The other thing I was going to mention is, so you had 10 candidates, right? 6 were invited. 4 were not, because they were considered not active enough for this debate. The one who missed was Matthew Ridenour, the former county commissioner. And while we were in the break, I thought, Jonathan, you mentioned something very interesting about Ridenour's candidacy, which was?
He is more of a – he's not really aligning himself with Donald Trump the way that the others will. So it'll be interesting. And he's doing really well in the poll so far, and hasn't raised as much money as Dan Bishop. So it will be interesting to see, is this an indication of what will happen in 2020? Those that align themselves with President Trump, or do they get primaried because there's this pylon in the Republican
Party? So you mentioned, Jonathan, just before the break, that McRae Dallas was the first in line to vote in Bladen County, and he's the central figure in the whole reason that we're having this redo. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, a bill was filed in the House this week in North Carolina to address concerns of state elections officials in the wake of absentee ballot tampering uncovered in Bladen. And I always get this wrong. Is it Robeson or Robeson County? I can never remember.
I don't think I've ever been there.
So what would this
new... We have a quorum. It's Robeson.
What would this new bill do?
Go ahead. I was just going to say, it makes it a Class 2 misdemeanor, correct?
Yep.
To receive a payment.
Yes.
Absentee ballots.
For absentee ballots. So, again...
Likely to pass?
I think it has a decent shot. I mean, I'm guessing here. I think it has a decent shot, just given all of the talk that we've had about this. But remember, Mike, this goes back to the debate we've had for years about voter ID, which has been the one that has really been concentrated on, versus the problem, which
is absentee ballots. Where the real problem is.
Okay. I will play devil's advocate really quick, Mike, and say I don't know, because of the fact that somebody, I cannot remember the legislator, they brought up the point that in California it's legal.
Okay. It's true. Good point.
So, Mary.
Yeah, just really quickly, I do think it will play out as a preview of what's going to happen nationally, because Trump, as president, was one of the few presidents who has not reached out beyond his base. He is the president of his base, so we'll see candidates all over the country. And you say it'll be a decision on if you're going to go straight into the base and try to turn that out, or if you're going to try to reach out.
Okay, let's hopscotch through some very quick topics very quickly here. City Council is considering ways to serve immigrants. We talked about this on the show this week with a group of people. They've launched this Immigrant Community Committee to listen to people who make up about 20% of our population. Our immigrant population makes about 20% of the city. And among the things the city is doing to respond to what they're hearing is developing a language access plan. What is that?
That's basically making sure that if somebody does not speak very good English, that they get the city materials and meeting coverage and things like that in the language that is their primary language. And the criticism of the city has been that it's really hard to figure out what's going on if you're an immigrant and you don't speak the language very well. Now, critics will say, well, they should learn English, and that is certainly true, but there's also the need to get information out there. Other things that they're talking about doing is hiring more multilingual staff for customer service jobs, recruiting city staff who speak languages other than English to do community relations. They want to set up a Spanish language academy that would help train potential future leaders in town, and they want to have more diversity and immigrant representation on volunteer boards and commissions.
So what's interesting about this is this all came about, if you remember, because of the days where we had those ICE raids, mm-hmm. and people were lambasting the council, saying, stop the raids, stop the raids. I don't really see anything in here that addresses that.
I think the idea here
you
is
can't.
The idea here is to make it clear to people that city government is responsive to their needs in a way that ICE is not. One of the problems that they have is there's people are conflating ICE with Charlotte Mecklenburg Police, with Correct. City government, and you know, there may not be a complete understanding that things are separate.
I said short. We're going to get to short. We've been talking a lot about school security on this program and around the community in recent weeks, but after a lengthy debate this week, CMS's Board of Education voted to eliminate from the proposed budget for next year funding for police officers in elementary schools. Why?
So Superintendent Clayton Wilcox put into his budget, based on the debate over how to improve school safety, put $2.7 million in to hire 25 school resource officers at elementary schools. And they debated this, and there was a split among the board, among those who thought that this was a good idea and those who thought you could spend that $2.7 million in other ways, in particular on more social workers to help with other problems in the schools.
Yes, board member Erica Ellis-Stewart says police can be effective, but because suicide attempts, depression, and other problems are on the rise in schools, emotional support staff are needed more. So did the board put aside more money for that?
They are spending more money for all of that, but the conventional wisdom here is that Mecklenburg commissioners won't approve more money for either of those two things.
Okay. So the state of North Carolina banned collective bargaining in 1959 because we are a right-to-work state. Now the legislature, at the behest of two, I think, Democrats, is considering overturning that ban. Those Democrats are both from the Triangle, Representative Zach Hawkins and Senator Wiley Nickel. Does this stand a chance of gaining traction?
I do not think so. Firstly, these are first term.
So
Democrats.
Why this issue now?
I think it has to do with the rise of millennials. I think this all has to do. There are polls out there and studies that say that millennials, younger people, oftentimes view unions favorably.
Yes.
But two dueling bills, House Bill 710 and Senate Bill 575, aiming to repeal that law. The state GOP quickly came out and said that this is an effort by people on the far left to do things that are not in the interest of families and children. I know that think tanks have said that there is no Republican that's going to latch onto this. If you remember, we do have a majority in both.
Well, let me ask you about that then, because this seems to be a tough nut for Republicans. Jeff Hauser, a spokesman for the state Republican Party, says the state has prospered under its status as a right-to-work state. But we are now in a populist climate driven largely by the success of Donald Trump as a presidential candidate and what he was telling people on the stump, what he was going to do for the working class. Unions have done everything for the working class. So I'm wondering how Republicans can be both populist and anti-populist at the same time.
And what's interesting, Mike, I used to live in Michigan, so I know this. Michigan, Wisconsin were two of the states that helped President Trump. In those two states, that was because people who support labor unions flipped. Usually they voted Democrat. They flipped and supported President Trump. So that's a good indication of your point.
Yeah. And that'll be the message of Democrats for 2020. Did he fulfill these promises when it comes to minimum wage and, you know, working folks and manufacturing coming back? And are you better off? And as you say, millennials who are graduating from college and seeing them not getting salaries that their parents did are going to be fertile ground.
And Democrats are clearly laying the groundwork for when they have a better shot in the legislature. The Durham City Council, which is all Democrats, endorsed this idea last year. So you can definitely see it's a big issue.
And some of this is coming up from the local level. They're saying, look, we've got problems. We have recruiting problems. This will affect everybody from teachers to police and firefighters. Just think about all the debates that we've had at our city council about paying them more. Right now, those groups have to come to the city council and beg for more money.
Keyword, we should have mentioned public sector employees.
That's
I don't know if we ever said that. Public sector employees is what we were talking about.
If you want to know, that you started this by asking, is this going to go anywhere? Well, it was referred, both bills were referred to the Rules Committee. All know nothing.
Yes.
Nothing escapes.
It's where the quills go to die. Yes.
Okay. Never to be seen again.
So the NFL draft is underway. Time to talk about the Panthers. More details emerged this week about David Tepper's plans for this new headquarters and practice facility, wherever it may end up being. York County seems to be the likely candidate, the first choice of both the Panthers and South Carolina's governor. But there is more to this than a practice field and a office building for a corporate headquarters.
I love
what are
story.
They planning?
Yeah, so they're talking about a sports medicine center, likely backed by Atrium Health, who is a Panthers sponsor. They're talking about office space, as you mentioned, probably hotels, shops. So they're trying to make it more than just a football center, which is the trend around the
league. And the indoor practice facility will seat 10,000 people and be big enough to host two high school football games at the same time.
Now we're talking.
Now we're talking.
Especially in Rock Hill. This that is a high school
yes,
football
they
hotbed.
They have three championship teams.
Yes.
So that is a big, big selling point. But to host 10,000 people and two high school football games at the same time.
I mean, that's almost as big as Charlotte Talks Live.
That's right.
It's big.
You have to have parking, et cetera. Is that right?
Correct. I mean,
they're going to have all this?
We're talking 200-acre development, obviously, in phases. But, over 10 to 15 years, that is what you would get.
And they are ready for. They've already put out renderings,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So the Panthers are looking for 150. We can talk about this with some levity because it's not in Charlotte. But the Panthers are looking for $115 million in incentives from the state of South Carolina to build what they are now beginning to call Football City, USA.
But despite Heritage USA in Portland.
What do we do with the water tower that's got a baseball on it, Mike? Go ahead.
I don't know. Repaint. But despite that's further north.
Yeah, that's true. That's Fort Mill.
Despite South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster's enthusiastic support for bringing the Panthers south of the border, some resistance has emerged. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about this. Several members of the legislature, including Senator Dick Harpootlian from Columbia, the legislature passed an incentive package in March, but Dick Harpootlian, as a senator, enters any senator in the South Carolina legislature, evidently can stop things like this for a significant period of time, and that's exactly what he's doing. And he told WFAE's Mark Rumsey that the numbers of benefits versus incentives just don't add up.
If this is really a multi-billion dollar deal, why isn't North Carolina playing for it? Why isn't Charlotte fighting us for it? And the reason is, this is fool's gold. This is a vanity project for the folks at the Department of Commerce and other elected officials who like the idea of having a pro football facility in South Carolina, even if it costs hundreds of millions of dollars of taxpayer dollars.
And here's why he says the numbers don't add up. The State Department of Commerce projects that this project will create 6,000 jobs. So he hired the State Department of Commerce's former economist,
yes,
who says the number is more like 200 jobs.
That's less, by the way.
Which is the number that the Panthers are projecting.
Well, the Panthers number is...
Where did the 6,000
come? So the Panthers number is the number of Panthers employees and players, which is, I think, what was it?
200.
Yeah, 200. Okay. The 5,700 that you're talking about was the spinoff effect, in essence. And so he's saying, and the economist is saying, 200. Mike, this happens all the time with these impact
studies. So Harpootlian says that someone is not telling the truth. Clearly, that's the case. Yeah. Clearly, that's the case.
Numbers inflated.
But he says, he goes on to say that the state will have to spend $40 to $45 million on an I-77 interchange to accommodate the traffic, and that Columbia needs that interchange, that Charleston needs that interchange, that Greenville and Spartanburg, God knows why Spartanburg needs it, because they've got 1,000 interchanges already. But he says they all need it. So is this really about politics and who gets what pork barrel project?
I think there's some of that. I know that's shocking to our audience and to our panel, but yeah, I think there's some politics involved.
Very quickly, Mayor Pete Buttigieg,
Buttigieg.
Mayor of South Bend, Indiana, running for president. He's number three in the Democratic rankings right now, and he's getting a lot of attention, and that includes Franklin Graham, who says the openly gay candidate should repent, calling homosexuality a sin and something to be repentant of, not something to be flaunted, praised, or politicized. Does Mr. Graham still support the president?
Yes.
Oh, he's a huge supporter of the president.
Why?
And always has
given
been.
Given his flagrant violations of morality.
Oh, you know, he's a sinner who's repentant. Franklin Graham has said that he's a true Christian. I think it's because of the judges, too, that he's appointing very conservative judges to the courts. And we saw near Billy Graham's, the end of his life, he became not as political, but his son, Graham, Franklin, is all in.
I want to play this very quickly. This is the Hurricanes winning. Play.
Hurricanes keep it alive. Williams touch the net. Score! The Carolina Hurricanes win Game 7.
And they beat last year's Stanley Cup champions, the Washington Capitals, in double overtime. So congratulations to them, and thank you all for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.